Hello, and welcome to Clinical Realities, a podcast series from The Lancet Rheumatology. In this series, we explore the realities of rheumatology care and research in challenging settings, specifically among underserved and neglected patient populations across the globe. I am Titi Lola Falasinu, Assistant Professor at the Stanford School of Medicine. In this episode of Clinical Realities, we discuss the state of clinical trials in rheumatology. Randomized clinical trials, or RCTs, are the gold standard to determine the initial efficacy and safety of medical interventions. There's a high volume of trials in rheumatology, but it can be difficult to enroll and retain patients in these trials due to a variety of factors. For example, many diseases in rheumatology are rare, some have unpredictable disease course, and many have heterogeneous manifestations. So today I will be discussing these issues with Dr. Michael Wiseman. Dr. Wiseman recently retired as the director of the Division of Rheumatology at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center at the University of California, Los Angeles campus. His academic and research interests for the last 40 years have centered on the genetic and environmental risk factors for outcomes in chronic rheumatic diseases. His experiences over the decades included organization and implementation of large-scale outcome studies and clinical trials funded by industry, government agencies, and multiple foundations. He has published nearly 500 peer-reviewed journal articles, and he has edited 12 books in the field of rheumatic diseases. In 2005, Dr. Wiseman served as the president of the Rheumatology Research Foundation and was named a master clinician of the American College of Rheumatology that year. Welcome, and thank you for joining me to talk about this important topic.
Thanks, Lola.
So one can imagine that the challenges to drug development have evolved over time. In your opinion, what are some of the biggest challenges in rheumatology, and which ones do you think have remained constant over the years, and what are some unanticipated and contemporary challenges that you think we're facing right now?
In rheumatoid arthritis, back in the 1970s, we had a disease with no really good treatment. And we had drugs that were very toxic and were only modestly effective. Those drugs were gold shots, penicillamine, antimalarials, and sulfasalazine. Those drugs had only a modest benefit. And the challenge then was to figure out how to show whether or not these drugs actually worked. And it was the genius of my colleague, he's now deceased, Harold Paulus, who sat down with his research assistant, Marlene Eggers, and took a look at the data that was published from sponsorship by the NIH, looking at gold, penicillamine, and sulfasalazine in rheumatoid arthritis, and said, we've got to have a better outcome measure. So what he did was he looked at patients that got the drug and then patients that got placebo, and he reconstructed the studies to look at the individual elements to come up with a measurement of an individual patient getting better or not getting better. And what were the characteristics of these clinical trials that actually made a single patient better? And when you looked at the data and you asked the question, I want to keep the placebo response as low as possible and maximize the intervention response, what were the elements that described a patient that got better? And those elements were 20% improvement in swollen joints, 20% improvement in tender joints, 20% improvement in a pain measure, and patient-reported outcome measures. And from that came what was called the ACR20. So the ACR20 actually came from clinical trial data in drugs that were only modestly effective. And it was the most sensitive measure that you could use to tell whether a patient responded or not. So it changed the whole world of clinical trials into deciding how many patients got better with the drug versus how many patients got better with the comparator. And so that actually is the genesis of what the ACR20 is. And over the years, what's happened is other specialties have borrowed that kind of information and applied it in lupus and in other diseases. But the most successful, of course, was in rheumatoid arthritis, developing this ACR20. And what it was a change score. It was a change score from point A to point B. It was not a disease status measure, okay? It was a change score. So you decided what changed and how many patients changed with the drug versus how many patients changed from placebo when you measured the difference between the two. So this was the origin, really, of all of clinical trials, sponsored clinical trials. So what's happened today is now we have drugs that are really effective. We have drugs that really work. So the ACR20 measure is no longer useful, okay? We need different measures based upon the fact that the patients actually are really getting better, not just from the drug, but also they're getting better from the usual standard of care. So today's standard of care is our patients that are doing actually quite well. So how do you decide what kind of measure to use better than standard of care? So this is the challenge today in drug development is how do you decide a drug is more effective when the basic patient is doing pretty well to begin with? In my day, in the 1970s, we didn't have that option because patients were doing poorly. So we needed a placebo compared to an active intervention. And it was fairly easy to show that your drug was better than placebo. And today we can't use placebos anymore because it's not ethical. You can't expose a patient to no treatment when in fact there is good standard of care measures available to take care of these patients. The other thing is rheumatoid arthritis is a different disease today than it was 40 or 50 years ago. It no longer is as severe and have so many extra articular features that we had in the 1970s. Patients are treated now earlier and more aggressively. And in fact, they're even now treated even before they get the disease in terms of clinical trials that do prevention based upon what's considered preclinical disease. So now we've moved from serious disease that killed people in the 1970s, where there was a significant mortality just having rheumatoid arthritis. We had drugs that didn't work very well. We had only a very sensitive measure, such as the ACR20, to tell the difference. To today, we have rheumatoid arthritis, which is doing actually quite well with standard of care that's already been proven to work, without extra articular features, without significant mortality due to the disease. So today, what we have are patients that die with rheumatoid arthritis of premature heart disease. So that's the challenge today in drug development, is to find drugs that can improve upon standard of care and potentially, down the end of the line, prevent heart disease, which is the major mortality feature of having rheumatoid arthritis. It's different from lupus. And we haven't talked about lupus. And if you want to talk about lupus,
let's talk about lupus, because you know I'm a lupus researcher.
Okay. Lupus is suffered from drug development. I don't know what the analogy would be. It's a big mystery. Okay. If you think of an ideal disease that you want to study outcomes, you would want to have the disease be easy to define clinically. You'd be able to figure out who the patients were to begin with that had the disease without question. You'd want to be able to differentiate the side effects of your drug from the clinical features of the underlying disease. You'd want to have that, okay? And you want to have excellent outcome measures to tell the difference between intervention and a no intervention. Lupus fails all four of those characteristics. It fails because patients' diseases are different from patient to patient, tremendously different. It's a disease that stops and starts over time. It has its own natural rhythm and natural remission periods. And most importantly, it's hard to tell whether patients are at the beginning of the disease or later on at the end of their disease. And finally, you know, we have really no good outcome measures that were developed from clinical trials to begin with. The outcome measures that are used in lupus came from observational studies, observational cohorts. And observational cohorts are not the same as a clinical trial. So that was the failure of the SLEDAI measure and the BILAG measure, is that they were developed from situations where patients were observed under their standard of care over time. And their disease state was measured at point A, and their disease state was measured at point B. And so these are not change scores. These are disease status scores from one point to another. So they've taken a disease status measurement, that is a SLEDAI or a BILAG, and converted it to a change score. Doesn't work very well. And that's been one of the problems with lupus drug development. It's not just the heterogeneity of the disease, but it's also the absence of scoring measures that were developed out of clinical trials. So it was a double hit, the development of lupus. And that's one of the reasons why it's taken so long for us to approve a drug in lupus, because of all these different challenges.
So as keeping our focus on lupus and maybe RA, how can we ensure that trial eligibility criteria are optimized so that their results are generalizable to the real world of patients with rheumatic diseases? For example, a recent study applied trial eligibility criteria to a lupus registry in the United Kingdom. They found that only 31% of their lupus patients and 51% of their lupus nephritis patients met the criteria for recently published trials. These findings suggest that inclusion and exclusion criteria may excessively constrain enrollment. What should we do to address this issue?
I think you have to look at it differently. All right. Clinical trials are an attempt to focus very specifically on seeing whether a drug actually works. And patients are chosen in these clinical trials in a period of stages, from stages 1, 2, and 3 studies, to be able to demonstrate that efficacy can actually take place in a group of patients so that the process can continue on after that. Industry makes what are called go, no-go decisions. They're investing a lot of money into the development of a drug that's going to turn a profit for them, so that they're going to construct clinical trials to maximize their ability to show efficacy. And when you do that, you have to create a scenario of inclusion-exclusion criteria to maximize that ability. Trials cost a lot of money, so that you want to have the number of patients down to a level that you can afford and yet give you enough power to show a difference, so that you cannot, when you start a project to develop a drug at the very beginning, you need to be able to have an enriched group of potential responders and a small enough number to show a difference between a drug and the comparator to justify the additional expense and commitment to further development of that drug. In other words, there's a method behind the way you set these studies up to maximize your ability to show a positive effect. Then once you do that, then you expand the patient population to make it closer and closer and closer to the real world. Now, the other part of drug development is safety. So what you do at the beginning is that you want to, if you have a new molecular product, this molecular product may have side effects that are unanticipated from your animal studies and your preclinical studies. So you want to be able to give this drug to a group of individuals to start with, to make sure that you're not exposing them to undue risk, because nobody knows, right? Nobody knows. So therefore, when you enter a group of patients into the early phases of this, of the drug trials, those are less sick patients with less other comorbidities to begin with, okay? So that you can at least get a window's view of safety in a population that could tolerate it, all right? So there's a method here in terms of industry-sponsored drug trials to make them look the best and the safest to begin with. And there, and then after that, you want to expand and develop into more real-world population and in patients that otherwise are closer to the population that are actually going to receive the drug. So all through drug development, everything is a bit constrained in terms of who gets the drug and who doesn't. If there was an unlimited amount of money and the patent life of these drugs was forever and the drug companies could do whatever they want, of course, this things could be expanded and include everybody in every country, in every place. But it has to be done within a budget, you know, that they have and a profit that they expect and the number of people that are going to take the drug at the end of the day, you know, are going to be able to pay for it, or the government's paying for it. Regardless of it, there are constraints on inclusion exclusion criteria for studies. And so that really explains why you can't look exactly at who gets the drug in the real world versus who got the drug in the trial. In the United States, in this country, anybody and everybody, any physician can prescribe pretty much any drug for any disease. There are no constraints on it. In Europe, if you have rheumatoid arthritis and you need a biologic drug, for example, those drugs are prescribed by specialists who have special training in the diagnosis and treatment of those rheumatic diseases. In the U.S., there are no constraints. So the FDA has a different battle in the United States than the authorities do in Europe, because there's a layer of expertise in Europe that decides who gets the drug, so that there are people that don't have misdiagnoses or are misclassified, as what's happened a lot in the United States. Okay? So if you just do a study like the one you're describing and you look at who actually got the drug, there are going to be different criteria for who gets the drug versus who gets the drug during a clinical trial. By definition, the clinical trial has to be restricted. And this is a bigger problem in the United States than in Europe, because the United States, as I said, anybody can prescribe the drug. That's why it takes longer for a drug to get approved in the United States than it does in Europe, because of the fear that the drug, especially an expensive one or one with significant side effects or side effects that we don't know of, okay, are going to emerge in a population that was never studied to begin with. What you're describing is not a method of that people are willingly trying to restrict it. It's the system of drug development which has certain safeguards.
So in that same vein, we also need to discuss whether trial populations represent the demographics of the patients who are most affected in the real world. So how do we encourage minority and underrepresented populations to take part in trials? What do you think are the key barriers?
It's a very complicated question, and there's no simple answer. The best way is to find out what are the reasons why patients don't want to participate in clinical trials and trying to understand what those reasons are and overcome those barriers. And very little research has been done to figure that out. I mean, you know, what are the reasons? And trying to address those reasons. Think of it this way. What about the vaccination hesitancy in the United States? It's the same issues, isn't it, Lola? And very little has been done to try and figure out what's behind this hesitancy and why those same minority groups don't want to get vaccinated against COVID or even vaccinated against anything. You know, there's a fear of that. So what are those fears? Those fears are government intrusion, bias, history. Somebody in the family died who they thought was due to a drug overdose or a drug side effect. I mean, there's a million different reasons why, and that has to be explored, why that's done. That's a unique problem in our country, is to try and engage subjects or patients into why they don't want to participate in clinical studies. I think that's the barrier. I don't think it's because people want to exclude them. There's no biologic there's no real biologic reason why you would exclude somebody who's African-American versus European-American, because the biology of the disease is not much different from one person to another. Now, there are differences in outcome between Black patients and white patients, but those differences in outcome have a lot more to do with, as you well know, sociodemographic and other factors other than the biology of the disease being different. So those differences really need to be understood more. And so you ask a complicated question to just a poor country doctor like me trying to figure out answers to these questions, but I turned it more around and said, you know, we don't understand it well enough to know why those differences take place, why people don't participate in studies and yet at the same time say, well, why don't you study me? And yet they won't participate in the studies. So, you know, how do you deal with that? What do you think, Paula?
Yeah, I think you're right. There are definitely multifactorial issues, like the history. But I think what we need to figure out is addressing it from also the clinician aspect and also the patient aspect. So are patients not being asked to participate in trials, and figure out ways to address that? And when they're asked, why they're refusing to participate in trials. And there was one study we did where we found that looking at the participation of women in a behavioral trial over at Emory, and we found that one of the biggest factors that hindered a woman from participating and actually continuing on in the trial was having children in the house. So with increasing in the number of children in our household, the odds of her participating in the trial and also being retained in the trial decreased by about 25%.
What do you think the reason that's causative of that observation?
Well, their responsibilities, and these are women with lupus, by the way, their responsibilities that many of our patients have to take care of. And trials can be very long. They can take you away from your job. They can take you away from your duties as a parent. So I think those factors need to be addressed. Yeah.
So there's the burdens of the home and the uncertainties of the trial itself. So there you talked about two really important factors then, uncertainties. Maybe there are certain minority groups are fearful of uncertainties, okay? Or those uncertainties appear threatening to them. They can't deal with uncertainties as well. As we study lupus women in pregnancy, we study their attitudes toward in pregnancy. One of the things we're learning, and I'm working with a graduate student who's doing some research in this area when it comes to, say, medication for lupus patients during pregnancy, medications that potentially have side effects, okay, or not, right? It's the ability to deal with uncertainty that is a challenge. And maybe certain groups don't deal with uncertainty very well, or uncertainty may be threatening.
And it can be quite scary, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And people don't like to be scared of these things, and they don't have the support system to help them, or their support system is even more scared than they are.
Yeah, yes.
Right?
Yeah, it's true, especially if they're the primary caregiver in those scenarios as well.
Sure. And if you're all by yourself and you're responsible for a whole bunch of people, you may have a different attitude toward uncertainty or toward participation in clinical trials than somebody else who has a huge support system behind them. So you're asking, I don't think it's the biology of the difference between people. Okay, this is what I'm getting at. And what you don't want to do is set up a bias, you know, saying that you know, we know the reasons why, so forth. I think what we need to do is find out more information about it, about trials. And I think why people want to participate in trials, we don't understand enough about it. There needs to be more research into it.
Yeah. So I think another kind of issue, also kind of fitting in with these issues of diversity and equity, is the exclusion of pregnant women from trials. So this is something that's essentially automatic. It's an exclusion criteria in virtually every trial. But of course, the problem is that then we have no idea about safety and efficacy of new drugs during pregnancy. And in many cases, there is not necessarily any obvious medical risk of a specific investigational drug during pregnancy. Some issues here, of course, like a lack of precedence and reluctance on the part of both the patient and the treating clinician to accept any experimental treatment during pregnancy. So how do you think we're addressing the issues of biases, of the exclusion of pregnant women from trials, and are regulators discussing this issue?
Well, the regulators are discussing this issue. We had a FDA summit conference on this very issue several years ago, and it was brought out very clearly that more work needs to be done here. But again, different people have different views of the risk of a congenital malformation. You know, that's a lifetime of a problem. And so what are the different attitudes toward that? And a lot of women, when they're pregnant, no matter who they are, will stop all their medication, even though the medication has already been proven to be safe because of the possibility that it could affect a pregnancy outcome. And the amount of guilt that would be associated with having that that kind of an outcome.
So definitely nuanced. So finally, let's talk about trial designs. There's been some conversations about how newer trial designs, for example, Bayesian designs and basket trials, could be the answer to the expensive nature of phase 3 trials, for example. These trials have been hypothesized that they could go a long way towards alleviating the problem of recruitment, particularly in the case of rare rheumatic diseases. Are there any talks within the FDA of modifying regulatory requirements with regards to trial design for rare diseases?
Absolutely, yes. The hot areas now are using the new trial design using positive controls and using the concept of non-inferiority studies. And they've, especially when it comes to less common and more severe rheumatic diseases, where you don't have a huge basket of people to be able to put into various phases of a clinical trial. So you have a limited number of people. The diseases are not as common, such as the various forms of vasculitis, for example, or orphan diseases of any kind, and severe, less common diseases like scleroderma. So the idea is that you set up what's an appropriate non-inferiority margin between what's an effective therapy and what you're new, you know, what's already out there versus what you're you know, what you're proposing as a new treatment. And these non-inferiority designs have now been successful. They have allowed for drugs to be approved by the FDA. So this is the whole new world. The second part is what are called pragmatic trials. And those are trials that are embedded within healthcare systems and healthcare units. And those pragmatic trials are usually they're minimally invasive, not a whole lot of exclusion criteria. They're using sometimes remote monitoring devices to be able to look at difference between one group and another. These pragmatic trials now have much easier to recruit patients. They can recruit a wide range of patients of all stripes and types, okay? And you can have large numbers. They're less expensive because the standard of care is applied to both, you know, both arms of the study. Those trials are moving forward. The other possibility is using registry data. The problem with registry data in the United States is it's so hopelessly biased as to who's in the registry and who is excluded, as opposed to in Europe, especially in Scandinavia, but also in, you know, in Middle Europe as well, that where all patients with a specific disease are being forced to register. And so you can have some idea of the range of severity of these subjects, right? And it sort of works both ways. In some cases, in these registry studies in Europe, remember what I said earlier in this discussion, that in Europe, only specialists are allowed to prescribe expensive, toxic medications. So that the usual patient that gets one of these drugs in Europe is different than the usual patient in the U.S., right? In U.S., anybody can get that drug, even patients that are misdiagnosed or misclassified or have less severe disease or live in Beverly Hills or whatever the reason, okay, they're going to get the drug, whereas they would not get it in Europe, where strict criteria need to be filled in Europe. So if you do these trials in Europe, you're only looking at a limited, restricted patient population in these registries. Whereas in the United, you can't apply that to the usual patients in the U.S., which may in fact represent a much wider spectrum of disease severity. So, and we don't have registries in the U.S. that include everybody. It's going to be harder to do that. What about the fancy design studies, the studies where you change the inclusion criteria as the study progresses? What do they call smart trials? Adaptive, right, where you adapt the strategy for including patients. That's very complicated. That hasn't worked well for rheumatic diseases for some reason, Lola. I don't understand it. It works much better, adaptive design, for endocrinological problems and other problems, but not for rheumatic diseases. And so the message is, and when I read over your questions and you wanted to talk about experience with these studies, with clinical trials, you know, the idea is that clinical trials have a purpose. They are not the answer to why you want to treat your patient who comes into the clinic. If you take only clinical trial data and apply it to develop guidelines for management, the patient that you see is outside those guidelines that comes in to see you, right? That patient is different from the ones that apply that were studied in those clinical trials. So the guidelines, which are only based on the so-called level of evidence of a phase 3 industry-sponsored clinical trial, only that tells you what drug to use and when. It doesn't apply to the run-of-the-mill average patient that comes into your office who's outside the criteria that were used to put patients into those trials in the first place. They may have more severe disease. They may have extra-articular features. They actually may have less severe disease. They may not have as many joints that are involved, okay? But they're still hurting. And they may have been excluded from the therapeutic trials. So how do you deal with them? They fit outside the guidelines. So the point I'm making is that clinical trials are done to restrict population for a purpose, to move a drug along, and you don't have all the answers before it's approved. You don't have all the answers about malignancy and infectious safety, which may take months to years to get data, and the clinical trial period was shorter. But the unmet need is greater. So you have an unmet need without any treatment, and you can't wait 5 years. And so you allow the drug then to be approved, and you develop a mitigation strategy, for instance, to look for the possibility of other side effects, which is part of the drug approval process. So I think that what the FDA does, which is very smart, is that they will approve a drug for an unmet need that may not fulfill all of the requirements that you would usually have, but the unmet need is greater. So they allow a observational strategy that's restricted to follow up on cases to make sure that we didn't overlook a safety factor. So they allow you to use safety assessment once the drug, you know, as an observational study in the real world, and it's a requirement for approval of the drug. You follow what I'm saying? It's a requirement, right? So there's all kinds of nuances and ways in which you can have a drug approval process that's both restrictive and not restrictive.
That was a really good summary of our conversation today. I'd like to thank you, Dr. Wiseman, and I would like to thank the listeners for listening to this episode of Clinical Realities. Remember, you can subscribe to Clinical Realities in the Lancet Rheumatology, wherever you usually get podcasts.